number one, was an attempt to create an intellectual and philosophical basis for Hasidut and not simply have it as an emotional experience. In fact, Rav Shneur Zalman often writes about a certain guy who was Lithuanian, and as a result, he came to Hasidut with the Lithuanian academic and intellectual temperaments, and he was a bit suspicious of unbridled emotion, and he always talked about the concept of the emotions being subjugated to the intellect and moral sense, which was certainly a corrective against other Hasidic excessive tendencies, which tended to emphasize the emotion over the intellect. So that's one reason. Of course, Kabbalistically, as we know, Chachma and Bina are the two upper sphirot, wisdom, which is the masculine principle, that is the sudden flash of insight, similar to the sperm, as it were. The Bina is the feminine development of the sperm. And again, in the imagery, in the sexual imagery of the Mekubalim, when the insight of the divine is developed into a full-fledged idea, giving birth to the blessings that shower the world, that is parallel to reproduction. And therefore, it is the unification of Chachma, which is the male element, with Bina, which is the female element, that through the union of dots, right, we talk about knowledge in the biblical sense, dot is the chibur, is the connection of the male and the female, and that creates the shefa, the abundance and blessing that God bestows on the world. And therefore the word chabad is not simply a synonym for intellectual chasidut, but it was a real description with very strong overtones of how to effect the unification, yichudim, the unification of these sfirot to bring blessing into the world. Once again, there were those who accused the Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman, of undermining the spontaneity of Chasidut, with his emphasis on cogitation, meditation, philosophical reflection, and the like. And he was a great synthesizer. He, in a somewhat unique way, he tries to combine in the Tanya, which is his classic work, Maimonides' philosophy, which he studied in the first period, and the Guide to the Perplexed, with the Kabbalah of Rav Moshe Koidevero, who was the predecessor of the Ari, with Lurianic Kabbalah, which are really very, very different systems. And he tries to make everything consistent, and as a result, the system is very, very complex. Some people describe the Baal HaTanya as a philosopher with a mystic bent. It's probably more likely that he was a mystic with a somewhat of philosophical bent. His dominant nitiyah was undoubtedly towards mystic and ecstatic experiences, but he was very, very well grounded in the classic works of medieval Jewish philosophy, particularly the Guide to the Perplexed, the Chovat HaLevavot, which is another Jewish work dating from the Middle Ages, the Sefer HaKalim, the Yosef Albo's classic work from the 14th century, and the Kuzari of Rav Yehuda HaLevi, the great Jewish-Spanish poets. These were the classic philosophical works of the Middle Ages, and Rav Shneur Zalman was very, very well versed in them, and he tries to draw on that tradition, combine it with the various schools of Kabbalah, and in effect he creates a system of his own. Now, one thing that many people have noted about Tanya, and again I'm going to try to get you some chapters to look at, is that although the vocabulary of Tanya is highly mystical, it is technical, it's the technical vocabulary of Kabbalah. So he talks the language of Kabbalah, but the Tanya can also be very, very well understood, as indeed Kabbalah in general can be understood, as reflecting psychological realities as well, meaning to say one should not be put off or scared necessarily by vocabulary. Every discipline has a technical vocabulary, but the categories do mirror the inner psychological states that human beings face in terms of love, fear, emotion, intellect, connecting with others versus the need for autonomy and withdrawal. These are the polarities and dichotomies that the Baal HaTanya, the author of the Tanya, writes about. It is said that the Tanya, in effect, took 20 years to compile. It's not a big book, but essentially it is considered to be the Chavon Raman Lubavitch Hasidim. It is called the Torah Shebiktav. It is called the written Torah. One of the thousands of pages of exposition over the past two centuries are the oral exposition of that written Torah. Rav Shneur Zalman was a multi-talented person in many, many ways. As we indicated, he was a world-class rabbinic authority on halakha. acknowledged as such, not only by Hasidim, but by Mitnagdim as well. His works on halakha are cited to this day by every school of halakhic Jewry. I mean, it has nothing to do with Hasidim at all. He was a world-class philosopher. He was a mystic. He was also an amazingly good organizer. He spent a lot of his time traveling from city to city in White Russia, in Russia and in Ukraine, establishing Hasidic communities. A lot of his time was fundraising. We have a lot of letters. Again, I guess some things don't change. A lot of his time was spent in raising funds from people who had some money to support the new Hasidic communities that he was trying to establish. He kept in very close contact with his followers, and eventually he had hundreds of thousands of followers already in his lifetime, with constant letters and trips, and his letters would both involve economic considerations. He would write about the importance of prayer, the importance of study of Torah, and in fact, the third and fourth portions of Tanya are really appendixes to the work, which are compilations of his letters to his followers. In fact, if you wanted to get into Tanya at an easier point, probably the easiest point to start with is not the actual book, which delves into Kabbalistic and philosophical matters, but to open up and see some of the letters that he wrote to his followers. Now, some of that is heavy stuff as well, but some of the letters will talk about things about not talking during prayer services and the importance of study of Torah, the importance of loving each other, caring about each other, not giving into machlokets, to dissension, and sinat chinam. So, he was
English?
Very...
Are they in English? Excuse me.
Well, the whole, the Tanya, which is five sections, has all been translated into English, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, so you can get an English Tanya. So he really was involved with the movement on many, many levels. He was a theoretician, he was a posek, he was a rabbinic decisor, he was an organizer, he was a fundraiser, he was an inspirer. Just a very, very involved person on many, many levels. In addition to the Tanya, we also have big volume of many of his discourses on Chumash. That is called the Kutei Torah. The Kutei Torah means anthologies on the Torah. It's a big volume, around 500 pages of very, very dense writing. That only covers Vayikra, Vamidbar, Tevarim, which is on the last three books. And then there's another volume, Torah Or, which means Torah is light, on Bereshit and Shemot. Much of his work had not even been published in his lifetime, but just over the past 20 years, the Rebbes of Lubavitch had in their private libraries many, many manuscripts, handwritten manuscripts from the Alter Rebbe and all of the Rebbes. And for many years they were not published, but the last Rebbe, who died a few years ago, made a conscious decision to try to publish all of that. So actually new things are actually coming out from the Alter Rebbe, etc. There's also a very, very excellent book by a Dr. Roman Foxbrenner called Chabad, which is an attempt to explain. He disagrees with your teacher, but that's all right. But nevertheless, it is a fairly thorough book on discussing the teachings of Chabad Hasidus. So anyway, the Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe, or Shneur Zalman, whatever name you call him by, is really a very, very pivotal figure. His influence, essentially, was throughout Russia and Lithuania. Lithuania was, of course, the stronghold of Mitnagdim, but to the extent Hasidut had any stronghold at all in Lithuania, it was primarily Lubavitch. He actually did not really live in Lubavitch. It's called Lubavitch Hasidim. He lived in first Lyadi and then Lyozhna, which are small hamlets in Russia. His son and successor eventually moved the movement to the town of Lubavitch, where it remained for around 150 years. And then it moved somewhere else, but it became known as Lubavitch Hasidut. Contrary to the image that Lubavitch has today, I'm going to devote some sessions to modern Hasidut just so people can tell the players without a scorecard. I'll talk about that. But contrary to the image of Lubavitch today as a popular movement that tries to, kind of Madison Avenue movement, catch the Mashiach wave or whatever they have. Lubavitch was actually a very, very kind of an elitist movement because it was very intellectual, very cerebral, very philosophical. People spent hours and hours, you know, studying these works, delving into the mysteries, etc. So it was kind of believed to be a Lubavitcher Chassid was kind of a point of pride. Not everybody was able to become a Chassid of the Bala Tanya, of the Alter Rebbe, or the like. The story goes that he once said on himself that he spent 21 years to understand the truth. He said 7 years to learn what truth was, and 7 years to drive out falsehood, and then 7 years to acquire truthfulness. So 7 years to learn the truth, 7 years to drive falsehood from his heart, and 7 years to absorb the truth. Just a few thoughts again from the Bala Tanya. He talks in the world, he gives a famous explanation to a Talmudic passage. The Talmud says, Kol HaKoes, anyone who gets angry, Ki ilu oveid avodah zarah. It is as So he came across the statement, which Maimonides quotes from the Talmud. It's not Maimonides' own statement. But kol hakoes, a person that has anger, exhibits anger, is an idol worshiper. It's as bad as worshiping idols. Now the Bala Tanya explains, why is it idol worshiper? We know it's not good to be angry, but what's the comparison to idol worship? So he develops a very, very interesting thoughts where he says that if a person truly believes, now this can be discussed again, it's a problem of evil and the like, but if one truly believes that whatever happens to a person is decreed by God, that God, if a person was humiliated for whatever reason, as a penance, as an atonement, God wanted that person to be humiliated at that moment, then what can one possibly be angry at? One can only be angry either at God, or one disbelieves that God is running the show. Mm-hmm. Either way, the Bala Tanya writes, that is idolatry, because in the moment of anger, you are exhibiting a feeling within yourself that you don't believe that God was in control of that given situation. That's the interpretation that he offers. Now, this little thought opens up really volumes and volumes and volumes of reflection about the nature of evil and the nature of suffering. Does it come from God? There is an approach that says, within the Jewish tradition, that evil and suffering is a function of God allowing human free will and autonomy. Meaning, one approach to the Holocaust, again, this is not a complete approach, obviously, but one thought that one might have is, well, listen, God created a world where human beings have the freedom to do good or bad. Mm-hmm. Why does God want a world of freedom? Because goodness is goodness only if it's chosen, and not if it's automatic. The problem is, there's a downside to freedom. That is, the freedom to do good also means there's freedom to do evil. Now, seen in that way, Hitler, Nazism, everything else, is the downside, the very, very awesome, awful downside of human freedom. And as many people say, instead of asking, where was God? One might ask, where was man? Meaning to say, it's not God's fault that human beings choose evil in the world. That's one approach. Notice the approach is, again, this is not exactly the same as Harold Kushner. Harold Kushner kind of suggests God is powerless. The traditional approach does not suggest God is powerless, but God created a world where he desires autonomy and free will. Therefore, evil exists because it is a consequence of the evil decisions that human beings make. Right? Like Dolph Hagen's book about even the ordinary German, you decide. Now, the Bala Tanya obviously is not accepting that idea, that kind of pacifist stance of the divine. Because if that's so, if somebody insults me, I have the right to get mad, because it's not God, it's him. He's suggesting it differently. He's suggesting God as kind of the active perpetrator. But of course, the question then becomes, that raises awesome questions about Holocaust and evil and the like. We can't propose to answer this, but certainly the Bala Tanya is suggesting that one way of dealing, psychologically at least, not with the Holocaust necessarily, because that might not be amenable to that psychological resolution, but to the slights and discomforts of everyday life, is to view them as mini atonements that God has given you. Teach us humility, teach us forgiveness, to teach us understanding. And in that way, he says, anger is treated as a denial of the divine role in life. It goes into the idea of Hasidut generally. And again, this creates, as I say, in the Holocaust, this creates very, very grave theological difficulties. But the notion of God being immanent, God being in everything, there is nothing in which God is absent. And therefore, the Bala Tanya says, Kas, anger, is an undermining and a denial of the divine. This is his interpretation in the Tanya. And of course, this notion, but again, all of this is rooted in earlier sources as well. This is not just an invention. For example, the Gemara says, if a person goes through 40 days of their life without any suffering at all, they have to be afraid they may have lost their world to come because they've gotten paid back for all their good deeds in going 40 days. So the Talmud immediately says, well, what do you mean by suffering? Do you mean something serious? Talmud says, not necessarily. If you're missing a button, if you stick your hand in your pocket and pull out a quarter and you pull out a nickel, that counts. If your coffee is cold, that counts. And in fact, there is a concept in halakha, therefore, that one should rejoice when one is faced with the frustrations and difficulties of life, because these things are kapara, these things are atonements. And that is certainly echoed in the Bala Tanya's explanation of kala koes, ki'ilu ovei avodah zarah. It's an interesting explanation, but you can see this opens up. That's why we say the Tanya itself is not fully addressing these things, but it alludes to things that need much further elaboration. Another mini thought, I think you may have mentioned this last week, I'm not sure. There's a statement in the Gemara that says, and this ties into Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, that Shammai and Hillel debated for 3 years, is it better for a person to be created or not? Yeah, I think I may have mentioned this. And the Gemara comes out, Noach liadam shalom yavram. It would have been better for a human being to never have been created. Because if you're not created, you don't do anything wrong, although you're not doing anything right. If you are created, you know, there's such a potential for things to go wrong. But the Bala Tanya offers a unique interpretation that the word Noah does not mean it would have been better, but it means it would have been easier. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the world as being the struggle to bring the divine, and that is the purpose of creation, to bring light out of darkness, etc. I didn't mention this last week. Another interpretation he talks about is that the world, there's a verse in Psalms that says, Shemesh umagen, the sun, a sun and a shield. Hashem Elokim is God the Lord. God is the sun, and God is the sunscreen, and it uses Hashem. That's the Yud Hei Vav Hei, Elohim, Elokim. So he explains, Kabbalistically, that from the Chachma and Binah, the masculine and the feminine that come together, through Dat, through this intimate knowledge, the Sfirot are produced. Now, if you recall, the first two Sfirot are Chesed, loving kindness, and Gevurah is restraint. And he talks about the fact that the world requires a balance of the loving impulse and the restraining impulse. See, it's a misconception that we often identify Chesed as the good thing and Gevurah as the punishment. Mm-hmm. That's not really true. The dichotomy is not between giving and punishing. The dichotomy is between giving and restraining. Mm-hmm. And restraint has a very positive function in the spiritual world. Even by simple analogy to raising a child. Chesed is what you give to the child. Gevurah is the discipline. It is said, therefore, that Chesed, Gevurah, is what gives form and shape to the Chesed. Some modern people compare this to the ice cream machine. You have a soft ice cream machine. If you don't have a little hole through which the ice cream gets forced, just a big blob, it is the hole that shapes it into the swirls and all the different things. Gevurah, therefore, is the mechanism, number one, that allows there to be Bechira, free will. Because if the world would be overwhelmed with the divine light, human beings could not exist as a separate entity. In the language of the Tanya, they would be like the flame of a candle that is submerged in a conflagration. Imagine if a building is on fire and there happens to be a little candle there. The candle loses its identity as it is engulfed by the flame. It is precisely God's withdrawal from the world, what is often called Hester Panim, the concealment of the divine that allows human beings to be choice makers. Right? That's obvious, because if you had a world, let's say, where every time you did a good deed, you got $1 million, and every time you did a bad deed, you got zapped with lightning, you would not be a chooser of good, you would be a Skinner's pigeon. Right? The Skinner's pigeon knows you push the lever that gives you the corn. So the Bala Tanya writes that Gevura is concealment, restraint, withdrawal, is the very principle that allows for the possibility of human good. Human good, human autonomy, human free will could not exist in the light of God. And again, this in itself is an alternative explanation for evil and suffering. In other words, you need a world that's off kilter. Because if you'd have a world that externally corresponds to the notion of good, that would take away the choice element. That would just be the automatic thing. And the way he ingeniously interprets the pasuk is like this. Look how he says it. Shemesh, the sun, is what gives you the light and the heat. That represents chesed, the light. Magen is the sunscreen. That represents the gevura principle. Hashem, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the tetragramming, Yud-Hei and Vav-Hei, that represents God's attribute of mercy and giving. Elohim represents God's attribute of din. So he ingeniously parses the puzzle. Shemesh Umagen, Hashem Elohim. Hashem, the name of Hashem, is that which is Shemesh, which gives light to the world. The name of Elohim is that which is the Magen, the shield. Again, everything in Kabbalah is very, very much has a very strong physical imagery. The sun is such a perfect imagery. The sun is wonderful. Life could not be without the sun. And yet, you need a sunscreen, you need a shield. Otherwise, you get blinded. Otherwise, you get skin cancer. On the divine level, it's the same thing. The chesed destroys a person unless there is gevura. And therefore, the Tanya is very much predicated on this notion of balancing chesed and gevura, etc. And this is something that we do in our own relationships as well. So this was the again, different thoughts. Again, open up any the Tanya at random, you will see many, many beautiful thoughts that one can understand, but also see things that are more difficult to understand. The English translations are annotated, and they try to explain things, but it's not it is not an easy book to go through. I think it is unfortunate that because it is so associated with a particular movement, Lubavitch Hasidim, people think it's kind of a Lubavitch book. It really is not. It is a classic of Jewish mystical thought that belongs to the Jewish people as a whole. It is not just the possession of a particular tradition. One final beautiful thing about the story about the Bala Tanya. It's interesting that when the Maggid of Mezerich died, and Shneur Zalman was going to leave to strike out on his own, remember he was the tutor. He was a tutor with the Maggid, son of Avram Malach, the angel, who was a very unusual person. Anyway, so the story goes, as they were tying up the horses, so Avram HaMalach, who really never got involved in mundane matters, made a suggestion about how you can get the wagons to travel faster. And he said, give the horses enough slack so they run so fast they forget their horses. And they'll get you there very quickly. So when Shneur Zalman just heard that thought, he said, you know, maybe I need to stay here a little longer. And he actually stayed another year and a half because he saw in this a very profound insight. And probably Rav Ram HaMalach meant to say it that way. And that is to say, how do you get a human being to soar? Now, human beings have certain animal aspects. In fact, one of the things that the Tanya talks about at a very great length is that we don't have one soul, we have many souls. There, again, this is not his invention, but he develops it a lot. There is what is called the nefesh habahami. There is the animal soul within the human being. There is that soul that animates physical life, and then there is the soul that is said to be the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God. Soul is not a unitary thing. Actually, in Kabbalah, there are five souls. He talks about primarily two souls. And he says that human beings, indeed, have much in common with animals. But you give people enough slack, enough respect, enough confidence in their own abilities, that they can forget they're like a horse in that way. Then they transcend that. By the time he said, just for that lesson alone, I have to stay another year and a half to try to internalize that particular approach. And as I mentioned last week, one of the major points of Rav Shmuel Zalman's Chassidut was that he tried to move away from the notion of the tzaddik being the intermediary and the emissary, and he very much stressed people's individual need of shlemut, of aspiring to perfection. He advocated simplicity of lifestyle, and he was against people going to the Rebbe for material needs. You didn't go to the Rebbe or the tzaddik to be successful in business. You went to the tzaddik not as a doer of miracles, but you went to the tzaddik as someone who could give you advice how to become more spiritual and close to God. That was the purpose. In fact, they tell a story. It's very interesting. That's why in many of the stories, and again, this kind of changed in recent years, but in the Chabad tradition, the stories about the different Rebbes, the Alter Rebbe's successors, very rarely emphasize miracles. Again, it did change a little bit. But they moved away. They didn't like miracles because they didn't want to look at the Rebbe as supernatural, some type of, you know, otherworldly figure. The stories they emphasized were stories regarding strength of character, midot, personality, devotion, self-sacrifice. Those were the things that they emphasized. In fact, there's a very cute Chabad story about a bunch of Hasidim were sitting around, and everybody was telling stories about their Rebbe, about the miracles. One said, my Rebbe, you know, said, I didn't have children for 30 years. My Rebbe said, you'll get pregnant, and my wife got pregnant, and we have to have triplets. Another person said, my Rebbe said, invest my money in this type of thing, and I'll be successful and I become a millionaire. Other than my Rebbe said, buy a lottery ticket. I bought a lottery ticket and I won. So finally, an old Chabad Chassid got up. And he said, I'll tell you a story. You know, I was struggling for a very long time. And my Rebbe said I should invest the little that I had in a business venture. And I had perfect faith in my Rebbe and I invested it. And the business venture went broke. And it was a total failure, didn't do anything at all. And I'm poorer than I was. So all the Hasidim were saying, what type of story is that? He said, what's the miracle? Said, the miracle was I remained a Hasid. That's a big, bigger miracle. That I didn't go to my Rebbe because he would get me money. I went to my Rebbe because he was a spiritual teacher. And the fact that he wasn't the greatest Wall Street advisor didn't make a difference. That's not why I went to him. And the Hasidim tell that story with a lot of pride. And it shows that they looked to their Rebbe for spiritual truth. Again, as I say, things got a little different in later years. I'm going to try to give you a kind of a lay of the landscape as to why that happened. But this was Rav Shneur Zalman. Shneur Zalman was a person who really felt that every person has to develop their own connection with God. And the Rebbe was there as a facilitator. And in that way, he was an indefatigable organizer, constantly writing letters, constantly making trips, constantly even collecting money to try to support these endeavors. And the money was not for him, the money was for the establishment of communities and the like. And again, one of the great, great figures of Chassidut. Initially, he didn't want to become a Rebbe at all. People started coming to him for advice, and he once turned to his wife and he says, why are they coming to me? I'm not able to do it. And his wife was psychologically very acute, and she told him, they're just coming to you because they want to hear a teaching from the Maggid of Meserich who died. They're not coming for you. They're coming because you happen to know the Maggid of Meserich's teaching. And he said, all right, well, that's true. That I could accept. But of course, once he began teaching, he started to say his own thoughts as well. Okay. Yes.
Well, this is a question asking for a little more detail about the difference between the idea of freedom of choice versus God-hiddenness. The necessity for the hiddenness Are they the same in that that is the state of affairs, or is the hiddenness sometimes more hidden than this kind of thing? And does the Tanya try to...
Well, you know, the Tanya is not a treatise about the Odyssey per se, meaning to say, the Tanya does not comprehensively address the issue of why is there suffering in the world. Certainly there are ideas from which one can formulate an approach. He does talk about the hiddenness of God as a condition for human free will. That if God's presence would be open and revealed, and if goodness would always triumph, there would be no virtue of being good. This is the irony. In a very real sense, evil is a necessary evil. That's exactly it. Evil is necessary. It's a byproduct of the whole system of free will that God has created. In fact, he points out, again, this is from Kabbalah, but he draws upon it, that even the word olam, which is the word for world, olam, comes from the word he'elam, which is concealment. He'elam, ayin, lamed, mem. Lahalim is to conceal. That the nature of olam is that God is be'elam. God is in a concealed state. In fact, the way the Ali, when we talked about this at the beginning of the class, beginning of the course, that this is the Ali's doctrine of Tzimtzum, that in order to create a world, God had to contract within himself. God had to withdraw within himself. There would be no room. The Ali has a very physical notion. There would be no room for this desk if God is here. God had to withdraw, as it were. Of course, on one hand, you see, Rosh Neir Zalman denies, this is why there are aspects of conflict here, he denies the concept of God not being here. Right? That was his interpretation of anger.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that was one of the criticisms of the Vilna Gaon against the Tanya, that the Tanya was pantheistic, because God is in everything. But God is also concealed, and not evidence. The notion of Helam is so. Is reinterpreted in the Balatanya's lexicon as not referring to actual withdrawal, but the appearance of withdrawal and concealment. But it's only appearance, it's not reality.
Is there ever in Tanya any
Well, he says that sometimes punishment is the consequence of God's goodness. We say, that one does not have the sense that God is taking care of it. One feels the badness. But he emphasizes at all times that this is just an appearance. This is not a reality. That there is a reality, in fact, which in a sense that. But certainly, punishment is a function of the gura, the ra's withdrawal. Not so much punishment, it's God giving you the appearance of being forsaken. But again, I'll try to bring in the chapters of the Tanya, but again, it's hard to know where to start because the Tanya is a big book and it's kind of a sustained discourse. But certainly at the letters, there are various letters that are doing that. So that is Rav Shneur Zalman. Now again, just so you have a cognitive map, we start off with the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov's two major successors were Rav Yaakov Yitzchak, the one who wrote the Sefer Toldot, who was kind of an acerbic anti-clerical critic. He didn't like rabbis too much, although he was a rabbi for a while. And and the Baal Shem Tov's successor spiritually was the Maggid of Meserich, who really was the pivotal organizing force, who had the vision of creating this religious revivalist movement. And we've completed, really, our discussion of kind of the inner circle of the disciples of the Maggid of Meserich. We talked about Rav Elimelech, his brother Rav Zusha, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, and Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. These were kind of the leading disciples. So that's already the third generation of Chassidut, Baal Shem Tov, Maggid of Meserich, and this third generation. Of this third generation, the only one of these founding fathers, as it were, who actually founded a dynasty, per se, is Rav Shneur Zalman. In other words, the other ones still belong to Chassidut in general. You don't really have the distinct dynastic significance until the fourth generation, which we're going to talk about tonight. Rav Shneur Zalman, however, did establish the Chabad Chassidut. Again, it's called Lubavitch, but really the technical name is Chabad, Chachma, Bina, and does. You may know that many Lubavitchers to this day had a custom that every single day of the year they study a portion of Chumash, a portion of Tehillim, Psalms, and a portion of Tanya. Something that they do every single day. And they have printed calendars to that effect. Again, if you're not Chabad, there's nothing wrong with that either, but they don't think. And the way their calendar works, their calendar is not run from Rosh Hashanah. Their calendar runs from the 19th of Kislev. If you remember, we discussed last week that the 19th of Kislev was the date that Rav Shneur Zalman was released from his imprisonment in St. Petersburg, and that was called the Rosh Hashanah l'Chassidut. That was called the New Year for Chassidut, and they actually kind of, in a way, start their year on Yud-Tet Kislev. To this very day, Chabad Chassidim make parties on the 19th of Kislev, shortly before Hanukkah, to celebrate the release of the Alter Rebbe from prison. And I mentioned again, pardon me if I'm repeating, the younger than Doreen, I forget what I said last week, but all the other speeches I can make very nothing. But I mentioned that when Ralphie Levy was released from prison, he had to spend a few hours in someone's house, the wrong prison. This is a very, yeah, okay, so, and he said, it was by accident, he had to spend 4 hours in a bitter McNaggate's house in St. Petersburg. And for 4 hours, the prison was just degrading. And he said that was a lot worse than the few months in jail. But okay. All right. Now, what I want to talk about is this. Keep in mind what we have at this point in terms of organization. Rav Shneur Zalman died 1813. By the time, this is already almost 100 years after the death of the Baal Shem Tov. He's been around already. And at this time, there are already at least tens of thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of followers. Keep in mind that although in the preceding 20 or 30 years, we had these very bitter fights between Chassidim and Mitnagdim, culminating in the various excommunications of the Vilna Gaon and the like, but by the death of the Baal HaTanya, much of the Hitnagdut, much of the fighting, has kind of died down, because number one, Chassidim, number one, had become more normalized, in a large degree because of Rav Shneur Zalman's influence. Keep in mind that his Lithuanian bent, his emphasis on Talmud Torah, in effect, addressed a lot of the concerns of the Vilna Gaon. So it's a very strange irony that of all the people the Vilna Gaon refused to meet, it was precisely the person who was the most similar to the Vilna Gaon in outlook. And yet, in effect, the Baal HaTanya was a major force of rapprochement between Chassidim and Mitnagdim. Also, as they are growing in numbers, the Russian government themselves empowered. See, it used to be in the legal structure that was in effect, all institutions were under one single Jewish community. And this community controlled many institutions. They controlled the Jewish court system. They controlled Jewish ritual slaughter. They controlled hospitals. They controlled charity funds. And consequently, many of these communities, part of the struggle between Chassidim and Mitnagdim were who had political control over these legally recognized institutions. Well, what happened was the Russian government, toward the end of the Baal HaTanya's life, actually empowered Chassidim and Mitnagdim to establish their own separate institutions. And as a result, they no longer were vying for the same pie. They had two different pies that they could cut up. That itself diffused the tensions because there were no longer power struggles. There was legal recognition, just as you'd have Christian, I mean, in a way it's a schism, in a way it's unfortunate, but just as you would have, you know, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, so too you had Chassidim and Mitnagdim. Everybody had their own thing. And as a result, they weren't crashing into each other. That was the second element. A third element, so we talked about, in other words, number one was the normalization, in quotes, of Chassidut, coming, converging towards the mainstream, which, by the way, many Chassidim thought was a betrayal. That was not accepted so nicely by some Chassidic leaders. Some thought the Baal HaTanya was a capitulator in his approach. Okay, so you have the normalization of Chassidut. Number two, we have the sheer numbers. You can't ignore it anymore. Number three, we have the legalization of the separate institutional structure. In number four, there's a fourth element that should be mentioned as well. And that is, sometimes warring factions unite when they have a common enemy that appears on the horizon. And the common enemy that appeared on the horizon, not so much in the Balatanya's lifetime, but relatively shortly thereafter, was the rise of what later became known as Haskalah. Haskalah is translated as the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Now, from, depending on your perspective, you know, some people's perspective, they look at Haskalah as a very vital and significant movement that tried to bring the Jews out of the darkness of ghetto life and expose them to education and culture and make them a part of society. That is the way some people might view it. Again, I don't want to get into the politics of that. Suffice it to say that the Hasidic movement viewed Haskalah as a deadly, pernicious poison that would destroy the foundations of Jewish living. And in this sense, they formed allies with the Vilna Gaon school and the like, who also viewed Haskalah. So in a way, the rapprochement between Hasidim and Mitnagdim was triggered to a large degree by the rise of Haskalah, and including movements like the Reform Movement, which was beginning in Germany and in Hungary. Again, as they say, the common enemy allowed, from the perspective of Hasidim and Mitnagdim, they regarded these movements as an enemy which they had to fight with all of the weapons at their resources. So these are really four reasons why, although the war against Hasidut is a very, very interesting war, but a very bitter war, but it's a very, very short-lived war. And by the 1820s, by the second decade of the 19th century, for the four reasons that I've indicated, it was no longer a major issue. And the Balatanya, as I say, was a major factor in both his moderate conciliatory approach and his emphasis on not allowing emotions to take over, his emphasis on halakha, his credentials as an authority. Remember, part of the Vilna Gaon's criticism was that the Hasid, some of the rebbes he thought were not learned. Mm-hmm. One could not say that about Rav Schneer Zalman. And in fact, it's very, very interesting that the Vilna Gaon's greatest disciple, Rav Chaim of Volozhin, according to him last week, like a stomach ache and a headache. But Rav Chaim Volozhin, in spite of the fact that his Rebbe, his teacher, the Vilna Gaon, was so bitter against Hasidim, Rav Chaim Volozhin, used to Rav Chaim of Volozhin, because his city was Volozhin, Lithuania, had very good, amicable relationships with Hasidic teachers. He considered them mistaken in a number of respects. But he wrote a little treatise, that's called Nefesh HaChayim, the soul of Chayim. It's kind of a pun, because soul of life, because his name was Chayim. Mm-hmm. And Nefesh HaChayim, he never mentions Hasidim by name. He always refers to those who seek the closeness of God. He refers to them in a euphemistic way. But he tries to draw on Kabbalistic sources to show why Hasidut was misguided. Meaning, he tries to use the very sources of the Hasidic movement, and he attempts to demonstrate that in his judgment, they are misinterpreting Kabbalistic sources. I'll give you a few examples of that later. But what is notable about Nefesh HaChayim is that the tone is deferential, the tone is respectful, the tone acknowledges that the motivations of the other side are good and noble, and it's simply in the tone of very, very respectful debate. Contrary to what the Vilna Gaon himself, I'm not even going to talk to you. Nefesh HaChayim is an attempt to engage in a reasoned dialogue. So on one level, Rav Chaim Volozhin fully endorses the Vilna Gaon's general Weltanschauung, right, view of life, but it's done in a very, very different way. Let me give you an example. Remember that one of the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov was the concept that a mitzvah that is done without feeling and without emotion is an empty shell, and it's not worth very much. A mitzvah has to involve the fear of God, the love of God. A prayer without kavanah, a prayer without thinking about it, is worthless. Now, this resulted in some groups of Hasidut that if one was not inspired to pray in the morning prayer, mm-hmm. you just didn't do it till the afternoon, kind of. So he shows the opposite, that in Kabbalah, it is the action itself that is of primary significance. Remember, I talked about this, that in Kabbalah, there are actually two nuances. So certain Kabbalistic writings stress the importance of the internal experience, and certain Kabbalistic writings stress the importance of the precise calibration of the action, like a mechanical thing. You're manipulating levers that bring things together. And Rav Chaim Leshner, of course, drew on that tradition to emphasize the primacy of action and the primacy of Torah study and the like. In fact, he even used a beautiful Talmudic precedent to show you the syllogistic logic of which he was certainly a great, great practitioner. He says, there is a passage in the Talmud that talks about Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven, as being an otsar, being the treasury, the storehouse in which one keeps their Torah. In other words, if one learns Torah without fear of God, there's no way for the Torah to be kept. You learn it, it goes away, it doesn't stay within you. But when you have reverence for God, that is the storehouse that preserves the Torah. So Rav Chaim Leshner says the following. There were Hasidim that felt, one should not spend a lot of time on learning Torah. One should say the Psalms, one should think about God. But he said the following. He says, if in fact we compare Torah to grain, and we compare Yirat Shamayim, contemplating God, as the storehouse of grain, the preserver of grain, let's examine the halakha. If you buy grain from me, and grain rots, and grain spoils, how much preservative do I have to include with the grain? This is a question of halakha. You want to buy 10 tons of grain. How much preservatives do I give you? So the halakha is that 1/24 of the grain that I sell you should be preservative. So if you're buying, let's say, 24 pounds of grain, I got to give you a pound of preservative. So Rav Chaim Leshner suggests this ratio, look at the plan here. If we call Torah the grain and the contemplation of God the preservative, he says the appropriate ratio is that 1/24 of the time you spend studying Torah, one should say the Psalms and one should contemplate the divinity and the like. So if one is doing it for 10 hours a day, so you take 1/24 of that time. So he said, he actually borrowed that analogy. So, but again, as I said, it is very, very significant that in the Nefesh HaChaim, which in effect is an attempt to write a mitnaged book as a critique of Chassidus, the tone is very measured, very calm, and very, very respectful. So this war against Chassidus guy arrives almost immediately after the Domegov's death, although it did flare up. Remember, the Balatani was put in jail after the Domegov died, but that was kind of the last big effort against him. Rav Leib Yitzchak lost his job as Rav of Pinsk. I mean, there were a few atrocities, as it were, but after a while, it really died down. What I want to move into now, though, so what we have is the following. We now have a big, big Hasidic movement in Russia and in the Ukraine and in Galicia. Galicia is that portion of southern Poland that borders on Austria. Rabbi Elimelech of Lezhensk was situated in Galicia. What I want to talk about tonight, though, is the penetration of Hasidus into Poland's proper, Warsaw, Krakow, which eventually became the greatest repository of Hasidus. That was not Rav Shneur Zalman's influence, per se. Rav Shneur Zalman had Russia. Poland developed a very, very, again, I mean, you'll find Lubavitchers everywhere. You find Lubavitchers in China. You have Lubavitchers in Warsaw. But the point is that Poland was not the primary sphere of influence. Poland developed a very, very distinct tradition. A tradition that had some tragic overtones as well, but one that is still very, very vibrant to this day. Just to give you an example, the three largest Hasidic movements in the world today would be Lubavitch is the largest numerically, which is a Shneur Zalman. The second is Satmar, which is Hungarian Hasidic, which is a different tradition. We'll talk about that. Satmar. And the third is Gier. Gier is the epitome of Polish Hasidic Poland. And certainly before the war, before World War II, Gier was the largest Hasidic in the world. One out of every three Polish Jews before World War I were Gier Hasidic. or satellite. There were a lot of smaller Hasidic courts, like Alexander, etc. But they were satellite courts of Gary. Gary was the king, and then there were principalities, etc. Gary has a long development, which I want to trace tonight. And let's talk about the what you might call the Polish pioneers. Now, the Polish pioneers were the disciples of Rebbe Elimelech. So remember, Rebbe Elimelech is the disciple of the Maggid of Mezerich. So this is now the fourth generation. The founder of Hasidut in Poland, Krakow, not Galicia, not in Russia, was a man, Rabbi Yisrael Hapstein. The dates of his birth, 1746 to 1815. So again, his life essentially corresponds to Rabbi Zalman's life. Rabbi Yisrael Hapstein is not known as Rabbi Yisrael Hapstein that much, but he is known as the Maggid, also a preacher, the Maggid of Kuznitz. Okay, so don't confuse. The Maggid of Mezerich was the Baal Shem Tov's disciple. The Maggid of Kuznitz was Rabbi Elimelech's disciple. Rabbi Yisrael Hapstein was a very, very unusual person. He was born to a poor bookbinder. He was not born into a rabbinic family. His mother was childless for many years. His mother actually received a blessing from the Baal Shem Tov shortly before the Baal Shem Tov's death, and she gave birth to a child. The Maggid of Mezerich foresaw that that Rabbi Yisrael Hapstein would become a great Rebbe in Poland and bring Hasidut to Poland. He was a very, very gifted preacher, and he was one of the people that Reb Chaim Volozhin had close relationships with. In other words, Reb Chaim Volozhin was the Vilna Gaon's disciple, and he had a great, great admiration for the Maggid of Kuznitz.
Excuse me, yes. How do you spell the Gaon's? No, the Gaon's.
Gaon.
No, the one that follows him.
Reb Chaim?
Yeah.
Well, Chaim is...
I got Chaim in the last name.
Volozhin is V... That's a city. V-O-L-O-Z-H-I-N.
Volozhin.
That's pronounced Volozhin.
Okay. Volozhin. Thank you.
Right. Right. In fact, the story goes that when Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhensk was on his deathbed, he bequeathed different aspects of his personality to different disciples. And he said he gave his heart to Yisrael of Kuznitz. He gave his heart to Yisrael of Kuznitz. He gave his mind to other people. We haven't mentioned them yet, but I'll mention them as well. He gave his mind to somebody. He gave his intellect to somebody else. He gave his vision to a fourth disciple. But to Rabbi Yisrael of Kuznitz, he gave his heart. The Maggid of Kuznitz was known in his lifetime as a very, very gentle person, a persuasive person. He loved and understood even little children. We have a very, very moving description of how every Erev Yom Kippur, the men, women, and children of the town would come to him for a blessing before the great fast day. And they would cry and be asking God for forgiveness. And he'd come out and he would cry with them and he would say to them that I know better than you and I need God's forgiveness too. And let us pray together and God should have mercy on us. In other words, there wasn't the concept that, you know, I'm above, you know, we're all together. And then after they would cry together for a while, they would all walk into the shul. The whole community, the whole city, would come to synagogue together for Kol Nidre. This was described as the scene of Erev Yom Kippur. He was sickly. He was an invalid for most of his life. He was bedridden for virtually all of his life. Very, very thin, very emaciated. I don't know exactly what illness he had, but it is said that whenever he would begin to pray, he would be filled with a sudden energy, that when he would be praying, you would not even see the illness. And as soon as he finished, he kind of lost his strength again. Very, very amazing person. He wrote many, many books. Many, many scholars. This is very, very surprising, because number one, he was ill, and number two, he was very involved in his community. He was not a recluse at all. I mean, he was an invalid, but he was very much involved with men, women, children, taking care of people who needed it. Every day he was carried to the synagogue, even on a litter, but he wrote many, many books. In fact, interestingly enough, he is responsible for the rediscovery of the writings of the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal of Prague, this is before the Baal Shem Tov, the Maharal of Prague lived in the 1500s, in the city of Prague, and Amaral of Prague was a mystic slash philosopher who wrote books, very profound books, many areas of Jewish thought. And Amaral's works were neglected for a very, very long time, but they were rediscovered by Hasidim, and in particular they were rediscovered by the Maggid of Kuznets, who had a fascination with the Maral of Prague's writings, and even wrote commentaries on those writings. His primary book is the a sefer called Avodat Yisrael. Again, all of these are puns that include the author's name. Avodat Yisrael means the service of Israel. His name is Israel. On the Parshiot, etc.
Didn't he have something to do with the
Golem? The Maharal is the Golem, yeah. It's interesting. The Maharal is known by most people for the story of the Golem. But the truth is, Maral wrote many, many profound works. Actually, whether the Maral is a mystic is actually a matter of some dispute. Maral is difficult to classify. Maral does not use Kabbalistic terminology at all. He studiously avoids Sfirot. He does not talk about Sfirot. He does not talk about Tzimtzum. He doesn't talk about anything. Maral writes philosophical language. Maral writes like a medieval philosopher. And yet it's very, very clear that Maral was attempting to recast Kabbalistic ideas in the jargon of the scientific renaissance, including philosophical terminology and the like. So Maral was very much a mystic, although he did not write in mystical terminology. The Maggid of Kuznets was a great scholar, as we said. He was a great writer, a great speaker. But he had never forgot the poverty of his early years. It is recorded that he and his wife raised many orphans, and many of them lived in his own home. Chassidim at this point had begun to bring the Rebbe's money, but it is said that he had never retained anything for himself. Everything was given for others. When there was a fire in Kuznets, he used the money that he was given to rebuild an entire quarter of the city. In fact, the Polish government named the street after him, etc. They tell one story that a rich man once came to him, and he asked the rich man, "How do you serve God?" And the rich man said, "I am very, very ascetic. I only eat dry bread and I drink water." He says, "That's not what you do. You should eat meat and drink wine and eat bread and eat fancy food, because if you treat yourself very comfortably, you'll at least give the poor some bread and water. If all you give yourself is bread and water, you'll save yourself." "But I live on bread and water. I have to take care of the poor." He says, "You acquire more compassion for people."
How interesting.
"If you kind of indulge yourself a little bit, because we always treat others less than we treat ourselves. So treat yourself better, and you'll treat the other person better." The fame of the Maggid of Kuznets spread beyond the Jewish community. He was known in Poland as the Holy Man. First of all, as you know, the Polish people generally, the peasants, peasantry and the like, were very impressed by holy people. And very often non-Jews would visit him for brachot, for blessings. Again, there are some names, prominent names of Polish nobility. There's a whole story where there was a Polish nobleman who didn't have children. He and his wife did not have children for many years, and the Maggid, the bracha, gave them a child. He is memorialized in Polish poetry of the early 19th century. Used to some of the poems, non-Jewish poems, make reference to the holiness of his countenance, the gentility, the goodness of him. He was very involved in social welfare projects. He was involved in certain political activity. You know, Poland, which at that time was going back and forth between Russia and Poland, going back and forth, depending on the year, depending on the day, sometimes. But at various points, there were decrees against shchita, against ritual slaughter. Truth is, this was a recurring problem up through World War II. There was always attempts to prohibit ritual slaughter because it's cruelty to animals. Mm-hmm. And he was very instrumental in abolishing that. He got military exemptions for Jews who would have been drafted for many years, etc. He was also very involved in that the Hasidic rabbis of Poland were divided over the Napoleonic Wars. Remember, Napoleon is moving east towards Russia at this point. And there was division among the Hasidic rabbis. How to deal? Should we pray for Napoleon or pray for the Tsar? On one hand, the Tsar was very oppressive, and Napoleon was granting emancipation. But as we mentioned, most of the Hasidic rabbis in Europe said we were better with the Tsar than we are with Napoleon. because they saw a lot of dangers in emancipation and freedom. Haskalah, etc. I mentioned that Rav Levi Yitzchak was a prominent supporter of the Tsar back in the Ukraine. Rav Shneur Zalman similarly was against Napoleon. And this is also true with the Maggid of Kuznets. Maggid of Kuznets prayed. Now, again, Abubra has a whole book in this, but it wasn't just a question of who should win, but among the minds of many of the Hasidic rabbis, there was actually a thought that these great conflicts between Napoleon and the Tsar of Russia were the apocalyptic wars of Gog and Magog. You may recall that in the Bible. In the book of Yechezkel, it is said that before the Messianic era comes in, there will be tremendous apocalyptic destruction between two nations, which are not otherwise identified, called Gog versus Magog. There's no identity, we really don't know what those nations are. Could World War II have been it? You know, we hope. Otherwise, it's something worse down the pipe. You know, but at various points, they had a sense that the turbulence was so great that perhaps this was Gog and Magog, and therefore there were various prayers for Mashiach to come, etc. There is a legend that says that Napoleon actually disguised himself as a commoner, it might be apocryphal, and came to the Maggid of Kuznets to ask for a blessing. And the Maggid of Kuznets quoted a pasuk, but he mispronounced it. It says when Yitro told Moshe to establish judges. So he told Moshe, Nabol Tibol, which means you shall be worn away. So the Maggid quoted that pasuk, but he pronounced a pay instead of a bet. Napol Tibol, Napol, Napoleon Tibol shall fall. He says that's what it said, that was decreed. By the way, there was one exception. There was one Hasidic rabbi in Poland, a very prominent rabbi, who was actually a colleague of the Maggid of Kuznets, who wanted Napoleon to win, because that way Jews would have more freedom. This was Rav Mendel of Rimanov, which we'll talk about. And Rav Mendel of Rimanov used to say when he burned the chametz every Pesach for the few years that... involved in this. It's very, very interesting that right at the end of the Napoleonic campaign, after he was defeated, a number of these Hasidic rabbis died almost instantly. And again, the mystics connected to the fact that they were trying to bring Mashiach prematurely, and as a result, they were taken from the world. They were taken to Rav Shneur Zalman, the Maggid of Kuznets, they all died within the span of a year or two. Rav Shneur Zalman was 1812, and the Maggid of Kuznets was 1814. Etc. Okay. It is said that the Maggid of Kuznets' prayers, he used to love to speak to God in Polish, in kind of the direct, earthy way of the Polish peasants. And it is said that a number of times he was seen talking to God and calling him, I am a Polisher, my Kachanka, which means my darling. It's a term of endearment between a man and a woman. This is how he used to refer to God, to the kind of Polish, not just the regular vernacular, but kind of peasant's vernacular. And he actually admired the earthiness of people who were open with their emotions and expressed their emotions and had a certain sincerity about them. So he was very, very loved person. Again, he was not an organizer per se. He's what you would call the epitome of a pastoral person. He was not out to make new communities, but he was there to offer himself to anyone who needed him. And he was not the founder of a dynasty per se, but he was the one that established it as he did in Poland. And I guess one could certainly say, and one of the reasons why, of all the countries of Europe, Hasidut took the strongest root in Poland is because of the nature of the person that founded it. And therefore it did take hold because it was something in which everybody felt included. In a way that perhaps Rav Shneur Zalman's approach did not allow, precisely because Rav Shneur Zalman's approach was so intellectual and so deep that the average person really, you know, couldn't understand it. The Maggid of Kuznetsov was also a profound thinker, but not as systematic. In other words, if, for example, you take Rav Shneur Zalman's work and the Maggid of Kuznetsov, you see a very big difference. Rav Shneur Zalman will write about Shofar, Tkiat Shofar, right? Anyway, 20-page, dense Kabbalistic essay. The Maggid of Kuznetsov will give you like 2 pages of shorter reflections. It's very different. Rav Shneur Zalman was a very, very dense, complex thinker. The Maggid of Kuznetsov was more epigrammatic, kind of the shorter witticism and the like. And it was just easier to take in. And as a result, the Hasidut did become a popular movement in Poland, even more so than it did in Russia. As I said, at various points, 1/3 of the Polish population had some type of connection to Hasidut or the other. Okay, so now what we have is, therefore, Rav Shneur Zalman is the head of Hasidut in Russia. Reb Elimelech and his disciples have Galicia. The Maggid of Kuznets was the founder of Hasidut in Poland. But there's a second person who must be regarded as a co-founder. He is not a student of the Maggid of Kuznets. He is a colleague of his. They're both students of Reb Elimelech of Lizhensk. And this is a person whose name is Reb Yaakov Yitzchak Horowitz. And again, he is known as, he's 1745 to 1815, we compare the dates. It's almost exact. The Maggid of Kuznets is 1746 to 1815. This is 1745 to 1815. So they're contemporaries. Their lives are matched. And this Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Horowitz is given a distinct title. Even a chassid may not know who Yaakov Yitzchak Horowitz is. He's known as the Chose of Lublin. Lublin, of course, is a great city in Poland. Lublin is an old city in Poland. Lublin was a city in the 12th century. Okay. Chose. Now, what is Chose? Chose means the seer. That's right. There was a novel by Singer. The Chose of Lublin was actually, even more than the Maggid of Kuznets was perhaps more beloved, but in terms of actual disciples and the like, the Chose of Lublin is really even the greater founder of Hasidut in Poland. Let me just give you a quick rundown of names, and I'm going to go back over these names later, but just to get the information out. Too many notes. Why don't you just make a note of this? These are the school of the Chose of Lublin. Let me just give you a name of 6 or 7 dominant rebbes and poets who came from the school of the Chose of Lublin. One is a figure of David of Lelov, was a very beloved figure. David from Lelov. Lelov. That's called the Lelover Rebbe. Rav Moshe Teitelbaum, who of course went back to Hungary and was the founder of the Satmar Chassidut. That's Rav Moshe Teitelbaum. There is Rav Shalom of Belz, that is the Belzer Hasidic dynasty, which is still a major dynasty today. Rav Shalom of Belz, should we call it. And Rav Chaim of Sanz. All of these are major, major dynasties, and they come from the school of Lublin, the Jose of Lublin. We'll go back to the original. It says that there are so many important disciples. The Jose of Lublin, again, he actually studied for a short time in his life with the Magid of Meserich, the tail end of the Magid's life. But primarily his teacher was Rebbe Elimelech, just as the Magid of Kuznets was Rebbe Elimelech. And the Chose of Lublin did something that was very, very controversial at the time, and it created a lot of difficulty. That is, he started his own Hasidic court in the lifetime of his Rebbe, Rebbe Elimelech, which was the first kind of breakaway in the roots, where it was unheard of until that point to start becoming your Rebbe and start having Hasidim come to you when your Rebbe is still alive. And Rebbe Elimelech was kind of offended, and Rebbe Elimelech remarked, he might be greater than me, but everything that he is came from me just the same. Kind of the paradox where, yes, he surpassed me, but it came from me, and therefore he shouldn't do it. And in fact, well, that's right, but still, it normally was kind of a breach of etiquette, as it were, to establish a court in the lifetime of his master. And in fact, in Hasidic tradition, there were dire and dark consequences to that decision, some of which involved tragedy. For example, the Jose of Lublin, as I indicated, died in 1815, but he actually died under mysterious circumstances. He died on Tisha B'Av, actually, 9th of Av, but the Sukkot before, Simchat Torah, after Hakafot, which were around midnight, he went up to his room, his private room, which only had a single window, and the next morning he was found on the ground, as if somehow he fell out of the window. And he didn't die then, but he was found by somebody, and he just, before he lost consciousness, he just said, the evil forces have gotten me. And he lingered on all the way until the 9th of Av. But he died. And it is not known exactly what the circumstances were. Are we dealing with a possible suicide? Not that likely. Are we dealing with, sometimes a person may have lost his balance. That's a possibility. It was a relatively small window. It's not something that you would fall out of. Are we dealing with a murder? It's not likely that this is a mitnagei thing, because the difficult fights between the Mitnagdim and the Hasidim had already been more or less dissipated. Is it somehow connected to a curse of Rebbe Elimelech? Again, there's a lot of different speculation exactly what this is. But it is recorded as historical fact that he did die by falling out of a window, under mysterious circumstances. The court of Lublin, as I indicated, became a training ground for the great Hasidic movements that started in Poland. If the Magid of Kuznets was the personality that kind of lent Polish Hasidut a certain taste, but the actual progenitor of the schools was the Jose of Lublin. Why was he called the Jose? Because it was said that he had an uncanny ability to look into a person's soul and see what was wrong with them, what they needed, how they could be corrected. The Hasidim used to say, the moment the Hasid arrived, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak would take out his soul, remove the rust, cleanse the soul carefully, and then the person would feel free and pure, as if they were a newborn baby. People left his presence very comforted and hopeful, and he was always someone who greeted people in a very, very cheerful way. Interestingly enough, this might perhaps be connected with the events that happened at the end of his life. He himself had a tendency to be morose and depressed, and he felt that he was never righteous enough. He felt he was a sinner. He was very conscious of what he perceived as his flaws, which is interesting. On one hand, he started his own courts, but on the other hand, so he was very respectful. When he was younger, it was said that Rebbe Elimelech sent him to his brother Rav Zusha, who had a very good disposition, say, take this boy and cheer him up a little bit. Rabbi Amar felt that the depression would take him away from the service of God. He constantly waited on the poor. His concept of tzedakah was very interesting. He taught that tzedakah is not just giving money, but that tzedakah is to actually spend your time. For example, he would clean the houses of the poor. He would cook for them. He would cut wood for them. He felt that being physically involved in serving them gave them a sense of dignity and importance, and it wasn't just writing the check. And he even drew a halakhic analogy. He actually said that, you know, the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur puts on the white linen garments and goes into the Holy of Holies. Okay, we know this. But he goes in twice. The first time, he burns the incense in the Holy of Holies. That's divine service. The second time, he does it again, but all he does is take out the pan. So he says, you see, that cleaning up is also a divine service. Just to take out the pan, take out the garbage, is something that is worthy of emulation. And this was the Chozer of Lublin. Yes, it is said that the Chozer of Lublin was the chief initiator in this Napoleonic Gog and Magog thing, that he enlisted the Maggid of Kuznets to kind of pray for Napoleon's defeat, etc. And some Hasidic traditions connect his death to those messianic attempts of trying to bring Mashiach too early. They connect it all to that type of thing. Again, it's interesting. As we said, we have Shneur Zalman, the Maggid of Kuznets, the Chozer of Lublin, all died within a very, very short amount of time, and they were all involved in this Napoleonic agitation. To allow for the defeat of Napoleon. The Chozer of Lublin had many disciples. I gave you a quick list. I'll go over that list later. But I want to trace a particular line right now, and that is his greatest disciple was a disciple of the same name as him. He's also another of Yaakov Yitzchak. And he was called, in Yiddish, he's called Yid HaKadosh, which is Hayyudi HaKadosh, the Holy Jew. He was called the Holy Jew. He was born 1765, and he died 1814. He died as a young man. He died shortly after the Chozer of Lublin.
Was it the actual wars that took place, or that had been going on?
No, no, no. Napoleon had already been defeated. It was over at this point. Now let me just mention a few things about the Yid HaKadosh. I'll call him the Yid HaKadosh. That's the Yiddish way of saying it. HaYehudi HaKadosh, the Holy Jew. Why was he called the Holy Jew? Why was he given the name by the Hasidim? Number one, to differentiate between himself and the Master, because the Master, the Chozer of Lublin, had the same name, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak, so from the Holy Jew. Number two, there's a statement in the Talmud that anyone who denies idolatry is called a Yehudi. To be a Jew denies idolatry. And idolatry includes anger and selfishness and the like. So he was called the paradigmatic Jew because he repudiated in his life all of those bad midot, just idolatry, materialism, acquisition, and the like. There's a third interpretation, a third tradition, that says that he never liked to say anything as his own thought. So he would always say, this thought is from the Baal Shem Tov, this thought is from the Maggid of Mezerich, this thought is from Rabbi Elimelech, this thought is from the Chozer of Lublin. But once in a while, he would be saying a thought that was his own thought. So what would he say? So he used to say, I heard from an old Jew. I heard from a Yid. So since when people heard him say, I heard from a Jew, they knew he was talking about himself, he became known as the Jew, the Holy Jew. He too was a very, very kind and humble person. Again, that was the midah here. Now, if you feel, gee, everyone sounds the same, don't worry. We will get to certain Polish figures who are very, very good. We'll get to the Kutzker, and we'll get to people who are not kind and considerate, and we will discuss them as well. But the thing is the following: the Chozer of Lublin was victimized by his own medicine, and this was very bitter to him. Just as the Chozer brought pain to his teacher, Rabbi Elimelech, by breaking away and starting his own court in the lifetime of Rabbi Elimelech, who is by now dead, the Yehudi HaKadosh broke away, and he he established his own courts in the lifetime of the Jose. Now, some of this is shrouded in mystery. It's not just a question of possessiveness in church, because obviously if these are modest and humble people, that's not the issue. But there were some major, major ideological issues. One issue is the following. The Jose, like the Maggid of Kuznets, tried to be a pastoral counselor to the poor and to the needy. But what happened was, the very, very gifted, intellectual, brilliant students that the Jose had felt that their master had no time for them. There was no time, as it were, to delve into Kabbalah and to delve into the intricacies of halakha if one is busy cooking for the poor and taking care of the poor. And as a result, the disciples in the orbit of the Jose, who were brilliant and gifted in their own right, drifted to this Yehudi HaKadosh, who kind of spent his efforts with them. And as a result, the Jose felt that his most gifted disciples were no longer connecting to him, but they were connecting to his students. And he was left with, you know, having to take care of the poor and the needy and everything else, but the intellectual and spiritual growth was taken away from him. And Jose felt very, very bitter about this, and there was a very strong rift between the Jose of Lublin and his most beloved disciple, Yehudi HaKadosh. And there were years they didn't talk to each other. At some point, the story goes that the Jose, as an act of kindness and to show that they could still be friends and colleagues, gave the Yehudi HaKadosh one of his shirts or one of his articles of clothing, which among Hasidim was very treasured, to have something from the Rebbe. And as the Yehudi HaKadosh was walking in the street, a beggar approached him and said, "I need clothing." Mm-hmm. So he just gave it to the beggar. Mm-hmm. And when the Hasidim heard that he gave the Rebbe's thing to the first beggar that comes along, mm-hmm. they thought that this demonstrated a total lack of respect, mm-hmm. because he didn't consider the Rebbe worthwhile. And there was a confrontation, and the Yehudi HaKadosh said to the Jose, remember the Jose is the one who can look into a person's soul. He says, "Look into my heart, look into my soul. Do you see any jealousy? Do you see any hatred? Do you see any animosity in me at all? Don't you see my love for you?" And the Jose looked long and hard and said, "I don't see any. All I see is your love." And but nevertheless, there was a rift, and the rift was not entirely healed. In effect, what Rav Shneur Zalman kind of did in Russia, the Yehudi HaKadosh did in Poland, meaning Rav Shneur Zalman created a kind of intellectual, philosophical, introspective brand of Hasidut. See, again, this is moving away from the Maggid of Kuznets and the Jose of Lublin. If the Maggid of Kuznets and the Jose of Lublin were very much people who try to deal with the masses, which is really the authentic idea of the Baal Shem Tov, and try to address people's pain and take care of them in a pastoral way, Rav Shneur Zalman created more of an intellectual aristocracy. Well, the Jose and the Maggid of Kuznets were the same way as that earlier model, but the Yehudi HaKadosh also became kind of an elitist leader of great spiritual thinkers, which we'll talk about, some of whom we'll talk about. And therefore, one could regard, in a sense, the Yehudi HaKadosh in Poland as somewhat of a parallel to Rav Shneur Zalman in Russia. The parallel is very much incomplete, though, because, as I say, Rav Shneur Zalman was a great organizer and was actively involved in many, many communal welfare projects. The Yehudi HaKadosh was not. He was much more introspective and involved in internal spiritual developments and the like. The Yehudi HaKadosh is a very, very pivotal figure, though, because he does set the mood for what Polish Hasidut largely became later on. He de-emphasized miracles. He spoke of sincerity. He spoke of truth. He very much criticized pretension and superficiality. Again, like Rav Shneur Zalman, he de-emphasized the role of the Rebbe. See, again, it's very interesting. What's fascinating is that the more, as you would expect, the more intellectually based a system is, the less it emphasizes personality growth. A system that is geared to the masses needed some figure that the masses could hold on to. So the Maggid of Kuznets and the Chozeh of Lublin, who were personally very, very humble people, did give people the faith, though, that somehow by connecting to the Rebbe, things would be all right. Yehudi HaKadosh did not allow people to have that type of illusion. He was dealing with elitists. He was dealing with righteous men, scholarly men, philosophically inclined men. And to them, he taught the doctrine of truth, lack of pretension, getting away from superficiality. He said, parental merit is not going to help you, and a Rebbe is not going to help you, a Tzaddik is not going to help you. Again, just like Rav Shneur Zalman, each person has to develop that notion of their own divine services. Life is a battle, he taught, and unconventional tactics are sometimes necessary to win the war against the Yetzer Hara, the evil that lurks within the hearts of the human being. So this is the Maggid of Yehudi HaKadosh. Okay. All right, so next week I'm going to take this a little further. I'm going to give me 30 seconds. We're tracing a line here. This is the line of Polish Chassidut. We have the Maggid of Kuznets, which kind of is one particular strand. We have the Chozeh of Lublin, Yehudi HaKadosh. The next two people we're looking at next week is the Yehudi HaKadosh's great disciple, Rav Simcha Bunan of Peshitsa, who was called the Cosmopolitan Rebbe. He enjoyed playing cards and he frequented the theater, but he was a very, very unique figure. And Rav Simcha Bunan's great disciple was, of course, the Kutzker Rebbe, who is the most complicated figure in the entire Hasidic movement. And we move away from the kinder and gentler Chassid to a different type of Hasidic. Okay, so we'll see you next week.
The 25 book tour of the Zav, that you have to say that it's a creation of something from nothing, in simple language. That the universe, everything now, is created something from nothing. And the reason he says is not, and I want you to just pay attention for what is not the reason. The reason is not because it says so in the verse. Because it says Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim va'aretz, whatever. That is not the reason. Because you could explain or interpret every verse not in its simple meaning. There is no verse in the Torah that you cannot re-explain it in other ways than it appears in the literal meaning. This one says in chapter 25, book 2. He says, just as we did with other verses in the Torah, which showed God, you know, in a body, anthropomorphical, you know, and he spent the whole book to reinterpret this. To reinterpret the verses so that God is all spiritual and nothing, you know, when he says a strong hand, it doesn't mean this or whatever. So he says the same thing could be done with all other verses and under certain conditions. I'll tell you when. Listen first.
After you take a class of Hebrew, then you said, look at the text, enjoy the text, understand the text.
I'm telling you my interpretation of the Maimonides, for a certain reason, because I didn't assign you to read it, and I want you to know it. And then, if you're interested enough, like Scott, who is interested, I knew he would be interested, I told him not to go. The verse, who says literally ABC, if it's against logic, against reality, against proofs, and so on, then you reinterpret the verse. Otherwise you don't reinterpret the verse. You leave the verse in the literal meaning as it is. Now, he says, therefore, it's not because of the verses in the Torah that he says you have to believe, you have to say that it's a creation, something out of nothing, but because of the comment, of the sense of it, of the proofs, and so on. And then he gets into it, he says that, he says, and this is why Aristotle, when he says that the world was always and so on, he says that could not be. Not because of verses, but because of the belief and of his logic. On the other hand, he says Plato, that has a different idea about the heavens, that they, you know, they get lost, they change, they destroy, whatever. He says that could have been accepted, but for other reasons doesn't accept it. But certainly says Aristotle would in his belief, his theory would undermine the prophecy and the. And the miracles and the belief in reward and punishment and so on. And he says you cannot go and ask why did God do so and so, but he denies, you know, as I told you before, he is he's a big Aristotle Hasid, you know, but on the other hand he doesn't accept things, and this he doesn't accept. So but I found it interesting, and I wanted to tell you this, is because you know, we read sometimes verses in the Torah, and sometimes the word doesn't make sense to me. So there are ways of reinterpreting the Torah, or of understanding, not so much reinterpreting, as understanding the Torah not in its literary sense. And that's what he places.
Without reality, you mean literal?
No, but well, if you see it, you can prove it, and so on. You will read it, you'll see. I don't want to tell you too much about it, but I wonder if you should read it and see how you'll understand chapter 25 if you're interested in it. But basically, in book 2, what he says in that chapter is that if you have proofs and otherwise and sense and science and whatever, then you reinterpret the verse if the verse seems to be negated in literal meaning. It's not me, it's my mind. No, he did not point you to do. No, don't worry about that. Who could do it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know who could do it, but I think that in a way you can do it. You could reinterpret a verse. Now, for example, I'll give you a very simple thing. Okay, when I read Bereshit, Genesis, now a lot of people, you ask the question, I'm answering the question. A lot of people have problems, you know, very people who are traditional people have problems with science and Torah. They say, well, how can you teach Bereshit bara Elohim et Hashamayim et Haaretz, God created heaven and earth in 7 days? You know, the kids come from the science class teacher and they tell them it took millions of years. And to me, this is no problem. Not whatsoever. No? Well, yeah, I believe in God, I believe that God is the creator, but there's no contradiction. Because what it says in the Torah, it's not a history of science. See, I interpret Genesis as a lesson how to live. And the lesson how to live tells you that the important thing in the creation story is what? Is ordering,
order.
Is order, interdependence between the animals, the vegetation, so, and man's responsibility in ruling. These are the important values which Genesis is teaching, which the story of creation. But the last thing in my book is the story of creation teaching me the history of the creation, because that's not the point of the Bereshit. It's not the job of the book. This is how I, this is how I understand Bereshit, and I don't have a problem, which some people do have a problem. They believe in God, they believe in God created, they say, you know, how can you? So I don't have a problem because I explain it the way it is. So now this is, I think, what he means when he says that a verse could be reinterpreted. differently than the literary meaning if it's against, you know, everything that you see. And but I should, I certainly think that that is the point of the story. Okay, I now we have a go.
So is he allowing us to do it on our own, to interpret it on our own?
He doesn't tell that. I don't think he mentions that in chapter, whether you should do it on your own, whether the Chazal has to do it, this one you asked?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't think, if I remember, I would have to reread it, that he makes that point. He probably made, but I guess that he would say, if you have enough background, enough knowledge, you could attempt to do it. That's how I understand it. And also, by the way, in other writings, in Parashah and so on, he says that in the stories, the Agadotot of the Chazal, of the sages, some of them have to be understood as they are written. But he says many, if you understand them as they are written, you're really lowering the respect for the Chazal, because the Chazal had used that in a symbolic way. They didn't mean to give you some little stories which are nonsense. So he sees that even in the Chazal, that a lot of the so now if you, for example, read Perek Chelet, if you study the 11th or 10th chapter, depends on which version you got, of Sanhedrin, with all the stories there, which I do now, it's unbelievable when you really sit down and think about it, what these stories tell you. Not the stories in the literal sense, but the stories, what they teach you. Tremendous things. They teach you for example, I just did this Shabbat, I studied them. And I said, why are they telling the stories? And someone else, I said, well, I think they're telling the stories to show you that their view is that when it comes to Jewish history, yeah, there is choice and so on, but it's limited because God does intervene. And they have all kind of stories which, you know, you think why they're telling the story. But that's the point of these stories. Or for example, in 1994, A.O.B., I saw a story which is a response to that Jews are allowed to take, which I didn't think so years ago, repatriations from Germans or others. I will show you right there. So stories in the Talmud, in Chazal, are more than what is just written, if it has symbolic meaning. Now, and this is, I think, what he means when he talks about Torah. Okay?
Rabbi, you said that there are few
commentaries.
Why would we do the interpretation?
Of the Torah?
Of the text.
Why?
One, you said, if the Pasuk is against
our... Oh, and I said the only time that in that chapter he says that you should, mm-hmm. or that you can interpret not as a literal meaning,
I assume it's
not even when the Chazal didn't say it, but the Chazal said it, I assume he goes along. So if it is when it is against rules, against reality, against something
what
of that.
What is the other
rules? What did I tell you?
Because of the Emunah?
No. I'm saying if it's... No. You mean if the verse is against Emunah? No, he talks about the verse against, usually is you believe in what's written, it is traditional, but so he says you at one point you could reinterpret that if it's against science, reality. But you read that chapter, you could understand something else. That's okay with me, because you could read the same chapter and have a different understanding.
You said chapter 25, book 2 of the guide.
Page 192.
Yeah. Is it? Okay, thank you.
285. Yeah, I think it's 225. I read it
295.
Now I'm going to make a mistake. Okay.
Rabbi,
285.
I was looking in Torts because that's what I was going to talk about. And he says something similar to what you're just talking about.
Yeah.
There's always room in all spheres for ethical, supra-legal deeds.
There's always what?
Room in all spheres for ethical superlegal deeds. The individual is invited, not commanded to move beyond the letter of the law.
That is a little bit different. What he says there is that there is a din, right? There is
right.
a law. You are supposed, I shouldn't steal from someone. On the other hand, I don't have to give him, right? I
mean, but it could even go beyond that. Maybe kindness, you know.
Kindness is the law, and then a little bit more than that would be a... So that's a little bit different than reinterpreting a verse, you know.
What you're saying, but he seems to leave room in different places.
Well, I mean, Judaism has this thing that there is righteousness and there's Hasidut. It has nothing to do with the Hasidic movement that talks about. But Hasidut means to be beyond the law, to do both and beyond the law, to do extra things. And that is, there's always room for that.
I think it means
any other question? Okay, now, Marty, you want to start now that this?
Okay. המקום על השולחן. עכשיו רבי תלמיד.
My topic is basic principles of the Torah, and has Maimonides called them the 13 ma'amins, ani ma'amin, because if you take the siddur, zichron Ezra ben Zion, you have it in Hebrew and English. And even in English, it starts ani ma'amin. I believe with perfect faith that. And this is how each one starts. And he was the first one to set his 13 principles, and he called them the 13 ma'amins. And I have to share with you something very nice that happened this Pesach in my house. This is the first time after 20 years that I'm celebrating Pesach with my mother. She's, and I too, I was born in Turkey, and she's one of a big dynasty that was expulsion from Spain. And they spoke the language Ladino, which is some Spanish with Hebrew words inside. And when we came to sing the Echad Yodea, who knows one, and when she got to the 13, she started in Ladino, Quales son los trece? What are the 13s? So in our Echad Yodea is 13 Midaya, 13 Midaya. And she said, 13 Ikarim, and the Hebrew word for Ikarim, the main, the Ikar. And if you look at the Siddur, it won't say Midot, it will say Shloshasar Ikarim. Ein Kuf Reish Yud Mem. And that, in this moment I ask her, what do you mean Ikarim? Why we have Echad Shloshasra Midaya and you say Ikarim? Say, come on, it's Arambam. Mm-hmm. And Arambam is Maimonides. And Rabbi, you divided them into three sections, and I found in another book that we can divide them in 14 sections, four sections. The first section is God's unity, and we have 10 Ikarim in this one. The other one is reward and punishment. The third one is advent of the Mashiach. And the last one, Tchiyat HaMetim, resurrection of the... Yes. Now, in the Mishneh Torah, the chapter that was, I was assigned to read, he didn't mention all the tenths. He just took a few main of them. And then we'll see, I have that for those that he didn't talk about, and we'll just mention them. According to Maimonides, there is a first being, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who brought everything into being. All existing things, concrete, tangible, or spiritual, exist only through his true existence. Suppose that he did not exist. All other beings would not exist. Suppose that nothing else could possibly exist. He alone would still exist. Three things. There is non-existence would not involve his non-existence. All beings are in need of him. He is not in need of any of them. So if we look here, is the Word alone made, makes, and will make all things. As it says in Jeremiah 10:10, but the external is the true God. There is none else besides him. Deuteronomy chapter 4, 35. The second, Ani Ma'amin. The Creator, and this is how he calls God, the Creator. Blessed be he. The Creator is a unity, and that he alone is our God, who was, is, and he will be. And we know the song, Vehu Haya, Vehu Hoveh, Vehu Yeh, Betifara. And it's Adon Olam, you have it in your package in Adon Olam. And it says in Exodus and Deuteronomy, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other God before me. And when I quote this, I remember your lecture from last week. For the Maimonides, this doctrine is great principle on which everything depends. Third principle, God is not a physical body, as it said in the Chumash, the Lord is God in heaven above and upon the earth beneath. Mekomo shavo b'shamay nimal v'al aretz mitachat enom. Deuteronomy chapter 4, 39. Now, there is one thing very, I think it's very logic. If you have one physical body, you cannot be in both places at the same time. You cannot be in the heaven, you cannot be in the earth at the same time. And another thing, you can say to me, but there are many phrases in the Torah and the Chumash and the whole Tanakh that you have expressions of body, like Etzba Elohim, Yad Elohim, written with finger of God, eyes of God. So, how can you say there is no body? He's spoken.
What is being expressed? Because
the Torah is speaking to us in a human language. Idea. Now, you have the Igdal, the first thing, and we're going to refer to Igdal again. This is a poem written on based on the 13 Ikarim of Rambam, and you have here, Eno Dmut HaGuf, Ve'Eino Guf. Okay? Eino, he doesn't have. A physical body is not two places at the same time, as we said. The Torah describes God as a human being, such as written by Etzba Elohim. It is our duty, this is the fourth one, it is our duty to love and fear God. And it said, you shall love the Lord your God, Deuteronomy, you shall fear the Lord your God. The more one knows God and contemplates his great and wondrous work, the more he will love, praise, and glorify God. And when one ponders these matters, he will recall, Labriu, frightened and realize that he is a small creature. When a man recognizes God's greatness, he is aware of his smallness. Or as Rabbi said the other time, nothingness. In comparison, one should only pray to God. So, pray to anyone else to pray. Sixth, he didn't talk about six, he didn't talk about seven, not about eight, not a ten, not a 9, we're going to 10. All beings from the highest angels above to the smallest insects below exist by the power of God. He knows all, and nothing is hidden from him. He knows all the deeds of mankind and all his thoughts. He is the first and he is the last. Now, we can do a little quiz here. Take the Yigdal. Most of you are Hebrew readers, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Take the Yigdal and see if we can find in the Yigdal any correspondence to so far what we read, what we went through. You have the Yigdal?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Go to the first section, God's unity. Ain lo dmut aguf, ve'ain lo guf, nachon? Nachon? Chad ve'ain ki yichudo, nachon? Another one? Kadmon lechol davar, nachon meod? Od mashu? O yachlif ha'el ve'lo yamir.
Can you translate something?
Rabbi, can you translate? And no one with the good. We say, and no one with the good. Nobody.
Yeah, we don't have a siddur sitting here.
Oh, you want, and no one with the good. Yes, no one.
Here,
here the siddur. Here they are.
Here, here. And no one with the good.
Yes, she laughed. And
no one with the good. Not the right. Not the right. Not the right. Not the right.
As a matter of fact, the 13, you want to read it loud?
You're not the only one.
Which verse is you know what we can do? After I finish the 13, we can read the entire
the whole thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
It would be the better idea.
That's
okay?
Idea.
Yeah. So let's move to 11. The 11 is rewards and punishment. God rewards those who keep his commandments and punishes those who transgress them. If an idolater coerces a Jew to violate any one of the commandments under the threat, otherwise he would be put to death. The Jew is to commit the transgression. So transgression, death. You should transgress. Concerning the commandments, it is said, which if a man do them, he shall live by them. Live by them and not die by them. If one chooses to suffer death rather than commit a transgression, he himself to blame of his death. And I think it's a commit suicide, according to suicide.
What about you? You don't like that? That's a suicide is a punishment.
No, that's what he said. If one chooses to suffer death rather than commit a transgression, that's he himself to be blamed for his death.
Right. Now that means committing that someone is giving up his life for something that the Judaism tells him not to give up your life, but violate that ruling and live. And if you don't listen to that, but you try to be a holier than holy and giving up your life, you are a murderer.
You are a murderer of yourself.
According to Jesus, 7 or 9, that suicide is like murder.
But what he says, this rule applies to all commandments, but three. Mm-hmm. One is committing idolatry, chastity, and murder.
These three, right?
These three. You better then put yourself to death than to commit, to transgress.
Well, not that you should go die, but if someone comes to you and with a gun, he says, either I will shoot you or you shoot the next guy, and you say, sorry, I don't shoot the next guy. Right. And he will shoot you, although you know.
This is
that doesn't mean that you should shoot yourself.
One should suffer death rather than transgress this rule. Three. Second rule. Let's say 3-1. At the time of religious persecution, it is one's duty to suffer death and not to violate any one of the commandments. as a transgression was committed under duress, pressure, he is not punished with flogging, and he is not sentenced by court, by Jewish court, to be put to death. Death penalty is inflicted only on one who transgresses of his own free will in the presence of witnesses and after a warning. It's very specific because what he said, one suffers death so as not to transgress and does so in presence of 10 Jews, he sanctifies God's name, which means on Kiddush Hashem.
Who is the third? Idolatry and murder.
Sin is adultery?
I mean, any form of the forbidden, any
form of the forbidden sexual relationship.
And you're saying that the death penalty is inflicted only if you transgress in the presence of witnesses and your own free will.
Right.
Did I miss one? Is there one more?
No. Maimonides tried to make this principle very clear because of the religious situation. Remember we studied about the Almohades that said, either you convert or death. And there is, I think all of us know about Yehuda Halevi, the poet, and he said something that I learned a lot. The son of the servant's maid, Ishmael, which is Islam, pursues us with his hate. We turn pleading to Esau, Christianity, and he tears us like a wild beast. So, nowhere to go. And the 12th. The 12th is the Messiah, Mashiach. To lift the spirit of his fellow Jews in his generation, Maimonides' 12th principle of faith discussed the advent of the Messiah. Maimonides explained that the Messiah will be a king who will rise from the house of David HaMelech, and the Torah will be for him the object of study. He will look after the affairs of the government in accordance with the written and oral law of the Torah. I'm afraid the Messiah will. He will create a strong Israel. He will walk in the faith of Torah, and he will carry on a war for a religious cause. Now, I need here some help. What is the meaning to carry a war for religious cause? It's like what we had in our history, the Melech, the Judah Maccabi, and Bar Kokhba. What he means by religious cause? I really had more time with this.
Well, are you talking about
Mashiach.
But what he means,
the one
who will carry on the war for religious cause. I don't understand this. I'm afraid of this one.
There are two, no, it's nothing to fear. There are two sides to it. One is natural physical war, which is talked about, Gog and Magog, and dealing with that. Mm-hmm. The second is a spiritual war, bringing the entire world to a knowledge of God. It doesn't have to be, it's not a physical action, it's spiritual action. Already we see, and Rambam talks about in other places, that that Islam is part of the way there. They recognize one God, they don't recognize others.
And Christianity
Christianity is an interesting thing because of what they've done to other portions of their religion, but Christianity, there are portions that would say that this is the case. The Messianic prophecies, which he's talking about, say that at the time of the coming of the Mashiach, all of the non-Jews of the world will turn to the Jews and say, teach me of God. And that's what he's talking about. The prophecy is kind of spiritual.
He says they will accept the true religion. He doesn't really mean, I don't think he means that they'll be converted.
No, absolutely not.
That's what I'm not saying.
What he means is that, first of all, the big thing for him is that no one believes in idol worship. Right. You see, even the way he explains so many mitzvot is a reaction to
idol
worship.
Yeah, this was clear.
So the Melech HaMashiach, the king, the Messiah, will get rid of all the oppressions against Jews and so on. and you will succeed. But he will also get all the people to realize the idea of one God.
Okay.
And they see the Mashiach, they use the verse Mala Aretz Deyan, Kibayim Deyam Nechassim, that the whole world will be full of knowledge, of understanding, as water covers the you know, as ocean, as water covers the dry land. So you just inject the Hasidic word, since you're going to listen to Rabbi Breidowitz. So I'll tell you a Hasidic word. I think it's, I'll come back who said it, because it's about Mashiach. So he said that, what does it mean that the whole world will be like the water covers Kinyan Mayim Leyam Nechassim? He says, so the Rabbi said, when you look at the ocean, it all looks even on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But try the inside, there's so much depth here, and there could be a mile depth there. So he says, even when Mashiach will come, everybody will have some knowledge. On the surface, they will all look knowledgeable. But inside, there's going to be still great differences.
Okay. So, I'm happy that I understand. And Maimonides believes, that when the appropriate time comes, God will bring the dead back to life. Chazon Ahari,
I did not explain what he means.
No, not a word.
He never said what it means.
No.
And I looked
at this book.
Yeah, no, no, you won't find it. That is, there is all kind of, there were some attacks and so on. There is a whole Gerard Chiyat HaMeitim, but still I read it, I don't see what there are different opinions. All right, you finished or you didn't finish?
I have the Targil now.
Okay, let me interject, since give me an opportunity to say that.
Okay.
Now the Ramban, for example, the Nachmanides, talks about Chiyat HaMeitim, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them say that what it means is that people will, the righteous people, that's all I'll say, the righteous people will relive for a short time and die, and others, and why will they relive? In order to be able to earn more world to come. Because their purpose is not the living here, according to that. The purpose is to earn the world to come. But if you, a righteous person, when he will live longer, he will earn the world to come. A wicked person will not earn it anyway. So this is what some others say, that they will live a very long time and they won't die that fast. So this is, it's very obscure.
Similar to
Chazon
HaAtzamot
of Yehezkel?
Very
obscure.
A little bit something close to Chazon HaAtzamot of Yehezkel from Yehezkel?
So, but what happened was, this thing, what happened was at Samot? Are these people, there's the Talmud method story now, these people, once as, they really only symbolic, others say, well, he saw the descendants, they lived and all that. It's very,
okay.
Sorry.
Another thing that he didn't mention in Mishneh Torah, and we have it in the Siddur, is about prophets.
Yeah.
All words of the prophets are true. The prophecy of Moshe, our teacher, was true, and he was the chief of the prophets.
What do you mean? The Mishneh Torah, the last chapter.
The Mishneh Torah didn't say anything. Right. In our book. In our book, it doesn't mention it. But what I'm saying, that I'm adding more.
Okay.
About the chapter that we have in our book, there is more. So there are about prophecy, about Moshe, that he's the the chief of the prophets, those who came before and after, who followed him. The entire Torah now in our possession is the same that was given to Moses, our teacher. This the Torah will not be changed, and that there will never be any other Torah from the Creator, lest peace be named. He always ended. And another thing, all the other I mentioned. If we read now the Igdal, we can find, and this is a poem written based on the 13 Ikarim, 13 Zani Ma'amin, you can find, correspond, very nice phrases to go along with the 13 Ikarim. Let's see if we can find them.
You want me to read?
Okay,
you go. Hallowed be the living God and praised. He exists. Unbounded by time is his existence. He is one, and there is no unity like his oneness. Inscrutable and infinite is his oneness. He has no semblance of a body, nor is he corporeal, nor has his holiness any comparison. He preceded every being that was created, the first, and nothing precedes his precedence. Behold, he is master of the universe to every creature. He demonstrates his greatness and his sovereignty. He granted his flow of prophecy to his treasured, splendorous people. In Israel, none like Moses arose again, a prophet who perceived his vision clearly. God gave his people a Torah of truth by means of his prophet, the most trusted of his household. God will never amend nor exchange his law for any other one for all eternity. He scrutinizes and knows our hiddenmost secrets. He perceives a matter's outcome at its inception. He recompenses man with kindness according to his deed. He places evil on the wicked according to his wickedness. By the end of days, he will send our Messiah to redeem those longing for his final salvation. God will revive the dead in his abundant kindness, blessed forever.